The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Narrative wargaming is back on the agenda, and this time around, Jason has a deep and fascinating chat with none other than Thomas Pirinen. As is the way of these episodes, I just hit record, kicked back, and listened along whilst working away at the painting table. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I guarantee that you will too. Let's get right into it.
Congratulations, by the way. It's been quite a phenomenon, the Trench Crusade, hasn't it?
Nobody's more surprised than we. Nobody.
Really? You actually are surprised by it?
I mean, me and Mike just said we're going to, because we had to obviously fund all the sculpting and everything and do all our work for free during the launch of the Kickstarter. And we said, we're going to lose our pants in this. And we said, yeah, let's just do it, because for once we can do what we want rather than the creative turnip telling us what we should be doing. So we were totally prepared to lose our shirts and be happy about it, but it didn't go that way.
It's fantastic for me. I'm a businessman myself, but I'm nowhere near as successful as that. But it's great to see people taking risks and getting rewarded.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, on surface, it's very counterintuitive. So you go into a space where there is this absolutely, totally dominant player who is like unassailable. You do, instead of going for the mass market, because our game is, and the world is very much intended for mature audience, so you're narrowing your audience, then you're taking religion and its role in war as the main theme, which like no major games company would touch with a barge pole. Like it's a suicide. So on paper, none of it made any sense, but that's not always how it goes. The Excel doesn't always determine the fate of creative endeavor.
Well, thank you for joining us today, because it is creative endeavor that I'm really interested in. It's the narrative of things.
Excellent.
And are you quite a narrative-driven guy? Take it with Trench Crusade, you seem to be.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at my past experience, at Games Workshop, I did do a lot of things. But of course, the one that everybody seems to go back to is the Mordheim, which was very much a creatively and especially narrative-driven game, where it was all about the not so much about the playing a super balanced tournament, but creating a story with your friends as you play through the campaign. And in many ways, Trench Crusade on a very high level is a sort of gameplay-wise, and story-driven-wise, a reimagining of that, or at least taking that high-level idea and bringing it to 2026, because remember, I'm super old. Mordheim came out at 1999, so a lot of water has flown in the river since then.
Well, you'll have to make sure you keep that picture in the loft, because you're looking fine for it. Yeah. There's the
clean living.
Ah, there we go. That's my problem. Too English with my kebabs. The narrative side of things, then, is that when you were playing, are you playing often now, or are you too busy for it? Various games.
Oh, I play like continuously. I've been running an 8-year campaign of the D&D right now. I play board games. I try to play weekly. Obviously, I'm playing miniature games all the time, especially Trench Crusade, because I'm developing it. And I, on top of that, this is my industry, so I play a ton of video games. Remember, I was 20 years a video game designer, and I buy a lot of rule books, even the ones that I don't have time to play. I still want to study what's going on in the industry.
Okay. So when you play those games, is it are you quite a technical player, or are you more narrative driven, or are you a bit of a mix?
It changed a lot. When I was young, I was very much a competitive player, and that's probably not highly unusual. It's the really into winning, and the nowadays, I am very focused on the narrative side. I do think that having the competitive background was useful to me because you, even if you're doing a narratively driven game, you don't want it to be so that everybody just said, if we don't pick this one army or warband or character, you're gonna lose. Because that doesn't lead into good storytelling either if the game is completely lopsided. So I think I draw from my competitive past to bring it to the narrative present.
Okay, and when you do a lot of D&D, so that's you are the DM,
Oh yes, I am the epitome of forever DM.
right? Do you lean very heavily on rules when you're DMing, in the same way as when you do, say you've done the competitive side of things and bringing it to the narrative because you want a solid base in which to work, or are you a bit more free flowing?
I'm probably a bit more free-flowing, but if there is a dice roll, if there is a resolution, I play it by the book. And when I'm usually what happens with DMs is that they will cheat to favor their players. So when I know this is, even if it's a devastating results to the players, then I will do the rolls in the open course. Then that will create a story that isn't just driven by me. One problem you've got if you are 100% narrative driven DM or game master, whatever it's called, tends to be railroading and tends to be that you've already decided how the story will go and the players have a limited room to influence it. And I don't think that's good either. There is the saying, let the dice tell story. And while you don't want to be a DM that rolls, say, okay, it's first level characters, I roll on random encounter table. Oh, it's an ancient red dragon. Well, I guess they're all dead. You do not want to do that unless you've prepared something like the red dragon is actually looking for agents to work underneath it rather than just kill people. So I think you need both. If you're purely narrative, there is a big danger of not letting anything surprising and interesting and the memorable to happen. If you are just super strict rules guy, you might just end in a situation where it's not fun for your players.
Okay. So when designing your campaigns, whether it's for D&D or my formative years was around 6th edition Warhammer, which is why I was so interested to talk to you as much as anything else, because it's what everyone, it seems to be one of the more popular editions in terms of numbers of people.
Oh yeah.
And the thing that drew me to it so much is how complete it is as a book. You have everything that you might want to play in whatever style you want, and you can run your own campaigns. You've got the skirmish, you have the campaign trees, you have the siege rules, and you have a little bit of fluff in there as well. But you have quite a solid core for those competitive players. Because I don't know if I'm remembering correctly, but competitive play really took off around my areas
Yeah.
in. Around this edition. Is that your recollection too? And
Yeah,
just seeing it
absolutely.
so balanced.
Yeah. I mean, part of it was that the fourth and fifth edition were very hero hammery, which has its own charms. And I really, one of the mandates I had was not to rewrite the whole game. That was not the point, but to bring it a bit more balanced, bring some more attention to other models than just the big hero models. And that I think the competitive scene flowed from that, because before that it would have been, I would say, a little bit more difficult. Is the also Jervis Johnson, who started the whole Grand Tournament movement, had only just begun running them, so there was fertile ground for it to grow. But as for the completeness of the book, it's the from narrative point, yeah, that was by design. I wanted to cram as much value into the book as possible, because before, In 5th edition, if you wanted to do everything you said, you'd have to buy the actual rule set, so whole books and not just the book. You'd have to buy the siege rules separately, the skirmish rules separately, the campaign pack separately. So I and a magic system, which was a huge expense separately. That also was in the box. In the book. And I wanted you to be able to just get one book and do pretty much anything you want. We wanted to offer a lot of value for money because in this business, the what pays your salary is the miniatures. I mean, books are nice, but what was the plan there was, hey, you get this book, you can, whatever kind of a player you are, you're sorted. Now you can get the minis you need to play and you're off.
Well, as a young lad with next to no money, it was really a gateway to the hobby for me because of it. Because I did start officially on 5th, but as you say, there was no way I could get all the paraphernalia together to do the various things that I imagined in my mind. Now, you say that's obviously a lot of streamlining you did there. And I remember very fondly the campaign packs of 5th that you have your name to in many of them, as well as Mr. Thornton and I think Mr. Stillman.
Yeah, yeah.
Did those as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I have been able to look at in hindsight, and they're absolutely beautiful little pieces of work. And they're so varied, and they're so open world as well, because you can swap out the armies, and you at every stage there is a little bit of character being introduced. Now, when you streamline things down for campaigns, because I noticed that the campaign systems didn't appear in that format at all ever again. What would you say? Is it, did you not favor them as much because of the way things were, or is it what would you have changed about the campaign systems in 6th, which seemed to be diminishing in importance?
No, I think that had more to do with the player preferences. The campaign boxes, of which I'm very proud of, but they never were as big sellers, thus the army books, and obviously didn't drive the same amount of the miniature sales. So I am not surprised that they didn't really happen all that much after we did them, and they were done in a very specific period when there really we could not do more army books for the 5th edition, because there was already like 14 armies, and that's a lot of armies to keep track of, and there is only so much room for the toy soldiers in the physical shop, so there are all these things is the going against adding more army books. So this was the answer. But I think it was not a creative decision, and at that point it started to be less and less creative decision, and the sales said that, hey, new edition is coming, let's make army books, let's make codexes, let's make miniature ranges, because that's what pays the bills.
So that practical reason aside, the philosophical underpinnings of all of these games is narrative at its very heart, isn't it? It's the setting. Much like your Trench Crusade, it's so flavorful because of its, like you say, no one would have touched it from an officialdom point of view. No one would touch it. But yet it is popular. So simply everywhere I'm talking to people, it's because of its character.
Mm.
So even with the competitive spheres, they're looking for that narrative base, that character. Mm. Otherwise, it wouldn't draw them, even though they want to win at all costs. Mm. So why do you feel that it doesn't translate to as wide an audience when clearly it seems to underpin everything?
I think it is the for a like a mass audience, it is the amount of work you have to do. Like one thing that I think that works in favor of Trench Crusade and brings people to this, because it is a heavily narrative game, is that the rules are very easy to learn, even though I'm quite proud of the depth. You only need very few models. Terrain, granted, is a challenge, but terrain is always a challenge. So, and you only need one buddy to play against, and you're off to races. While with the campaign system, you have to get people who will commit to it. You probably need several types of terrain setups. You need much bigger forces since they're growing. So you are disadvantaged from the accessibility point of view. However, this is not the whole story. The great strength of the narrative and the lore-driven the playing is that you tend to get fans who are in it for the long haul, which in many ways are both from the creative point of view great customers, because they get really invested in the lore and they interact and they build communities for you. They will recruit players, And they tend to be like what you'd say a long-term customer. It's the because they are invested in the story and in their army or their warband, they will keep adding to it for a long time rather than just getting starter set, playing a couple of games, and they go, yep, it's the where is the next game?
Okay. So it sounds very much a logistics issue and a planning issue.
Yeah, I would also say that possibly maybe we live in a period where the attention span is maybe a bit shorter, and the campaigns are, they require a lot of focus and commitment, and maybe people have busy lives. Maybe it's harder nowadays. But that's a speculation. I don't have actual hard data, but I have a gut feeling that's true.
Okay. Well, you've got a very broad knowledge of the industry because you're in it in such a level. So that gut feeling isn't without value, is it? I mean, it's clearly quite a good overview to look into. So if you didn't have those constraints from a market point of view, and you were just trying to design yourself a campaign system, what would you consider to be a good campaign system? What would you think is most fun or accessible from your point of view?
Well, okay. Are we here talking about my dream campaign, or of course as far as the optimized campaign system? I just did it. I genuinely think that are you talking about like the old campaign boxes? Because Trans Crusade has a campaign system. The campaign boxes that we did for Warhammer were more involved and sort of where the story was partly given for it. Or are we just talking about that? Let's follow it. I have unlimited money and resources. What are we talking about here?
I'm quite free associative with my thinking, so I'm quite open to any of those options that you feel most drawn to. So it can be just the unlimited resources that you've. So it was your preference, but just okay. What you think makes a great campaign.
Oh, unlimited resources, have a incredible creative person running it. Like we're talking about we would cross Brennan Lee Mulligan and Matt Mercer and Jervis Johnson from the rules point of view. You'd have these incredible creatives who will create the story, and it will change according to what you do. And there will be crafted mini games between the matches. You see our friends at the Trench Titans doing this. They are running absolutely phenomenal narrative campaigns where they after every game they've come up with a new tactile mini game that determines certain bonuses and which way the story goes. Every scenario would be handcrafted for your players. So we're really talking there a campaign as a service. That would be the ultimate. And of course, you'd have a world-class miniature painters and converters. They provide any NPCs and the terrain. That is obviously, a billionaire might be able to afford that. Well, maybe a millionaire too, but not your everyday player. But that's obviously, because you can't really beat a supremely creative and experienced game master creating unique content for you. Of course, you would have a tailored experience. Now, that's not realistic. You can't put that in a box. If I'd want to recreate the campaign boxes, well, if you check our Kickstarter for Trench Crusade, we have promised a new campaign pack. It's called Carcass Front. And how would I say it? I don't want to quite reveal what we are doing, but maybe you'll see something you like there when it comes to a modern take on what a campaign pack could look like. But as for the sort of a streamlined narrative-driven campaign, I really tried to fix every problem I could think of. Catch-up mechanics, the exploration tables, how your warband grows and experiences, how do you resolve the long-term injuries. I really gave it my best effort in the Trench Crusade.
So I don't understand the term catch-up mechanics. Do you mind just unpacking that a bit?
Yeah. So a very, very common reason for campaigns, narrative or otherwise, falling apart is that you have your group of friends. Let's say there's four. One of them gets beaten to dust in three games. And,
yes. Okay.
And they can't compete anymore. They're just going, well, I'm just here, but nothing I do matters anymore. I am so crushed. That then that guy goes, sorry, but I don't really feel like playing because I'm just gonna lose. And then suddenly your campaign falls apart. So you need mechanics to bring them up to speed without making it meaningless that you're playing. Like if the guy is playing perfectly and still can't win because the catch-up mechanic is too strong, then that's not good either.
Okay, so that sounds a very delicate or well-crafted balance you have to make there. Is this all a built-in automated version of what a games master would be doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're basically, in this kind of situation, a good game master would go, okay, this the little Jimmy is the his dad played against him and just crushed him. He has one model left. He's feeling really glum. So an event begins. It's the Lady of the Lake hands the Excalibur to that last guy and say that you are now the King of Knights, and some knights come to help him, and the little Jimmy gets back into campaign and feeling really good about it. Because at the end, ultimately, it should be a narrative campaign, should be that it's a shared storytelling. Everybody's really enjoying what they are doing, and everybody's having fun, and the joy, and everybody feels they are participating, and they have a role to play and impact.
So very social driven as well, then, not merely the narrative. You want that social connections to be built into the book as well, the opportunities for that.
Yeah, opportunities. I mean, you can't social engineer anybody for campaign back, well, not very efficiently anyway, and you wouldn't want to. But you can create opportunities. Social play is the glue. As important as it is to get your lore and your art and your miniatures and your rules right, at the end of the day, if it's not a group of friends who are really enjoying the playing together, that probably won't last very long if it's not a great experience. So you want to give opportunities for a lot of social interaction, a lot of fun together, a lot of the opportunities to create memories together.
Do you consider the mechanics more important than the narrative in a game?
It depends on a game. I would say that...
In wargaming, perhaps.
In wargaming, the rules have to work, because otherwise the only thing you do is argue. There are various levels of success, but you need to get to a certain level where it's just your game is not stopped every 2 minutes of you and your friends arguing. No, the rule means this. No, it means that you have to get the in wargaming, because it's physical miniatures, measurements, exact combat resolutions that affect the game, and there is no DM to massage things. I think you can't do a war game, no matter how great the narrative would be, if it's acrimonious playing every time, and unfortunately a lot of games can be this, unless you have somebody in the gaming group who is willing to fix the rules for the game designer, then none can do. Having said that, it tends to be that the games that have a incredible lore and maybe so-so rules tend to do better than the games with incredible rules and so-so lore. The incredible lore tends to win out. The great narrative, great characters, great world building is so tactile, and it is so alluring to us as human beings, because ultimately it is a story you tell. So there isn't one like a cookie cutter answer for that.
Okay. Do you believe it's possible to get balance, true balance in games? In games that with these narrative drives and underpinning them?
Absolutely. Probably isn't going to be that much fun, because ultimately balance is the closer the two opposing forces are to each other, that the more identical their rules are, the more balanced it is. And that is not fun. I mean, a huge part of the fun is to encounter something new or play against something new or some new combination. And if both sides have everything is same. It's very balanced, but the fun goes out of the window. So it is absolutely possible. But the question is it desirable or not? And I would say, in my experience, no, you still want that the joy of discovery, of trying a new army or new warband or a new character or a new piece of equipment that has its unique rules, which creates new situations. And yes, that can lead into balance problems, but ultimately it's so much more rewarding.
So when you're chasing balance whilst trying to keep the character, which is quite integral to a campaign, isn't it, in some sense, because you want people to be able to, as you say, win at the end, also have a journey that they're engaged with. If you're having to introduce constant points of imbalance to keep interest, what are the points you're fixating on to make it a good campaign without losing that? Because people talk to me about balance, more competitive players of mine that I haven't. I'm going to put my cards on the table. I've always not enjoyed competitive play as it's presented to me. But my friends thoroughly enjoy it. And I don't know what they're chasing. And as a DM, that's obviously, I'm going in lame to try and keep them engaged whilst keeping my narrative players engaged. Is it just, what would you say on that? I mean, how would you?
Well, it is not 100% solvable problems. There tends to be like people who are into competitive tournaments. They're just not identical to those who are really into deep, satisfying narratives and don't really care if they win or lose as long as the story is magnificent. But there are tools. So one thing is playtesting. I know it's a boring one, but a lot of people say about a lot of games that, oh, this, that, or the other is so much more powerful. But you shouldn't listen to what people say. You should listen to the end results. Because if, say, you have a 4 factions in your game, and each one of them wins roughly 5% of the time. Well, even if everybody claims one of them is better, that's not what the data says. It's so it is a lot of work and a lot of data collecting, but playtesting is a great way. It's to strive for balance. It will not be this absolute perfection, and there might be good or bad matchups, but ultimately, then it's more about the skill of the players who are competing. It's than the rules you've written. But there is one very good trick I've learned over my years, and that is start from the beginning. So if you have a narrative campaign, sort out is your final battle that anchors it, or final scenario, whatever it is, and the work backwards from there. Because once you know how it ends, you can make sure that nothing along the way to it is the breaks it. So let's say you have a series of 6 battles. You start from the end, you go backwards or even forwards, and you go and get in the third battle and go, hang on a minute, if this character dies here, the ending that I planned will not work or will be totally unbalanced. Then either that character is not there, or he or she can't die in that the battle or whatnot. That's a very good tool for retaining the story you want to tell in narrative event while still is the maintaining a semblance of balance. Because at the end of the day, it usually comes down to the final battle. And if the final battle, you can arrange that there is a good chance that everybody arrives there, at least with a chance of winning, then you've probably done really well.
Is that for wargaming, or do you do that for D&D as well, for your campaigns?
Oh, all the games. Video games too.
Okay, so from my experience as a DM, it goes completely off the rails and down areas that I never knew would happen. It's very free-flowing from my point of view.
Yep.
How do you accommodate for that if you know the destination?
Because the destination in a RPG, like to be fair, my example was from a war game. In RPG,
of course, sorry, yeah.
You obviously have to take a choice. Is this a sandbox, especially if it's a pure sandbox, then yeah, that doesn't apply because it's a sandbox and the players go where they want. But if you have a free-flowing campaign in D&D or other RPG, but there is ultimately a narrative beat that happen, then you can use those. Really, for if it's a full sandbox, then why worry? If your players decide that they write the High King of Guards lives on that mountain, we're level 1, we're going to go there and kill him. And you look at the stats, yeah, that's not going to happen, but if they want to do it, they will do it. And then the King of Guards will kill them, and then you have to create new characters, or maybe the King of Guards resurrects them and they makes them, you're going to hell and you work for me. That could be quite fun. But that is then a very different than having a narrative red string to run full campaign. And again, I am not making a value judgment which is right or wrong. Both can work, and both depend very much on the kind of game master there is.
Okay. So that's the kind of way that we play war games in our little group. Mm. And it's very popular with people that are not entrenched in miniatures hobbying.
Mm.
It's a good way of them accessing the hobby, especially if we're presenting everything to them. But why is it that it's not as widespread, in your opinion, amongst war games? That sort of method.
The you're meaning about sandbox, like do whatever.
Sandbox you... play with war games, yeah. It seems to be more common in the 80s and 90s, and it sort of tapered off.
Yeah, the people usually want at least an illusion of fairness. And the sandbox isn't really, you're always wondering that what is the optimal way to play. And my mentor, Rick Priest, talked about this a lot, because the original Warhammer 40K was very, very, it was really an RPG. It wasn't a miniature war game. But people did not want to play that way. They wanted competitive head-to-head clashes. Even the narrative people tended to want it, and they would build the narrative within it. So the narrative came much more about the right. There is this kind of a battle. Here's the scenario. And these interesting characters on this interesting planet or place or a battlefield are facing over because the stakes are these. So the narrative comes from the grafting it around that experience, but the overwhelmingly, the players kind of don't want to feel that I'm already screwed because of the scenario, because why are we playing to find out who wins? The rules are because there is no DM. I mean, there was supposed to be one for 40K, original 40K 2. It's just, it's more difficult. You need a third person. That isn't, most of the time, people don't have that available, especially a good game master. So by the accessibility and the process of elimination, what we got is what most of the people wanted.
Okay. So hence why you have to craft such well-engineered campaign systems for that kind of mindset to function within in that middle ground, as it were.
Yep, you're creating artificial dungeon master in many ways. I mean, if you look at like the Trench Crusades campaign system, all the exploration events and the variety there, and depending which warband is doing which, that really is just a streamlined version of if I was running this open-ended campaign in the No Man's Land in Trench Crusade world, what you could encounter. Obviously, a book can only have so many instances, but then the randomness comes in, which means that the path through the campaign tends to be very different every time you play, and that is, it's not the same as having a really good game master, but hey, it's it can be a ton of fun, and it is certainly a lot more accessible.
So that very streamlined campaign system that you've designed for Trench Crusade, then it would allow the games master to come in and take it, should they so wish, and build off it.
Absolutely, and I hope they do. And I hope it is used to them, because as you probably know, it's on the role playing scene. There is a huge problem with the lack of dungeon masters and game masters. Like, that's why there are these websites where you bid for the services of paid DMs. And one of my friends, who is a very successful in the video games industry, he's one of those paid DMs. And here, I think he charges like $25 per session from his players. And he's like booked every second he could. And I think, you're not poor. Like, you don't need that money at all. This is pocket money for him. Why do you do it? And he said, because my players will actually show up if they pay. And I think, and that kind of a dungeon master who runs a ton of games all the time of different systems, I know this from my experience, because I use this all the time, this kind of the tables that the sort of are dungeon masters aids, that they generate interesting items, events, characters on the fly, treasures. They are very, very, very useful, and I hope they are of use to some of the people who get the Trench Book Crusade rules.
Is this Trench Book Crusade campaign systems and development systems a variation of the core way you would like to have done it in 6th edition Warhammer?
Not exactly, because the Warhammer 6th edition was an army game. And it's much easier to do deep campaigns when the number of models and therefore characters is much smaller. As you noticed, this both in Mordheim and Trench Crusade, I limited the number of characters who can gain upgrades and experience to 6, which makes it much more manageable for the players to handle it.
Would you treat it at a regimental level then?
I would probably treat each unit of multiple models as one character, I think. So you'd have your regiment would become a big red one, or the Finnish Ace Regiment, or the Night Witches, or whatever. It's the Red Baron's Flying Circus. And then they would get the character that way. Because you do have to respect the mental load you're putting your players under. It's overwhelming them with rules, and especially bookkeeping rarely leads into success.
Okay. So I once had a very brief talk with you on Facebook that you probably won't remember, because it was amongst 10,000 others that were engaging with you at the time. It was one about where I was at the very beginning of my journey, and I asked you whether I could use the 5th edition magic system with SIP. And I ended up doing your recommendations on that. And it's worked very well, because as you say, people haven't had to learn anything, because I hand over a magic item. I hand over a spell. So you've really got me fired up there with the idea that not overloading your players. I didn't realize that was the thing. I just did it naturally because that's what people responded to, rather than me knowing why. Mm. But it's an overload. They didn't want to do the bookkeeping.
Yeah. And this was very different in my youth. It's in my distant, dim youth. It's I come from a different world, because not everybody is staring at their phone 24/7. And they distracted by ping pong, TikTok, ding dong, it's social media with 15-second bite sizes, because it modifies your brain. So for me, like, I played my first D&D games, you draw your own character sheet, and everything was, you'd use rubber and a pencil. And this to me was natural, and it was a ton of bookkeeping, especially for a more complex system like Rollmaster or billions of others. To me, that was just the way it is. But we don't live in that world anymore. And you have to work with your players so everybody has fun.
How do you accommodate for that cross-generational difference in attitude towards the games? Because I've got a lot of different age groups I'm trying to mesh together, because it's one of my things that I like to do, is get the different generations and different sexes engaging in the same game. But it's that middle ground. How would you navigate that?
Roles. On a simplest level, you give there is a young kid, you give them a champion fighter. There's very little for you can't ask for a very young child to have the same kind of a attention span and focus and maths. As a very experienced player, you give them a straightforward but really fun character and give them big personality, like Minsk. And then you give more complex characters to more advanced players. Maybe you have somebody who is not really into the fighting. You tailor make them a social character. Maybe some of them doesn't like violence. You give them a healer, and then the most experienced player, you nominate them as you give them a character that's the sort of the natural leader, and they have a job. Maybe they have the magical map in their mind that everybody has to follow. So they have to take the burden of the guiding the party. Again, that's a lot of work, but if that's what you want to achieve, then you have to do the legwork.
So that's mirroring the social hierarchy that exists anyway, in some sense. That's what's sort of going on in their lives.
Yes, it is. But they won't necessarily do it naturally, because we are very visual creatures, most of us. So your youngest player might see a picture of a wizard casting a fireball and think that's really cool. But wizards are a really difficult class to play and play well, and have a ton of bookkeeping. And if you have a 6-year-old kid, that's probably not the best possible combination for them having fun on being able to contribute to the overall narrative. So a little bit of a help and guidance, is the then they will be looking at you anyway as the game master to helping them.
So we run rather big games, narrative games of Warhammer, about 2,000 miniatures, 16 players. The youngest people are around 16, 15. The oldest are however long humans can survive. And there's quite a difference in the three generation groups in how they come at these games. Would that translate over what you've just said to the wargaming in that sort of setting as well, that sort of thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here is the thing with the there is a reason why my original, when I wrote the Trans Crusade rules initially, I said, I want to make this as replayable, and that means you need depth game as possible, and it can take only 2 pages. That was my original brief for writing the Trans Crusade rules. And I've had to extend it to 3 pages, but that's still manageable. So you don't want to write 3 different games. That's a lot of work, and you're just splintering your player base. So you should rather provide the players and the game masters, if game has one, with tools and aids that to support different groups, rather than the try to design the game for everyone. Rather, it's the you make it as accessible as possible, because the reality is that if you make it for the most experienced person, then you will lose the others, because there is only so much complexity most people are willing to put up with. It's and this is the same trend is visible in video games as well. And then you bring that extra depth and sorry, not depth, the complexity. It's the through the suitable player aids. There is, of course, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate to myself, there is always a counterculture. That you can be like the Dark Souls or Dwarf Fortress. There are games in video game space that are mind-numbingly complex and still popular. They are niche, but they are very big niche games. So there isn't only one way to paradise, but we are now, I presume, talking here about mainstream audiences.
Well, that's what I'm trying to access is the mainstream through something which I know is a niche hobby in the wider world. Although I'm not sure how niche it is now. I mean, perhaps you can tell me that, because it seems to have grown significantly since I was a child.
Oh, it's grown massively, but you always have to remember that the numbers still, in video games industry, you can sell 30 million copies, or you can have 500 million players on a mobile game. This is still a gigantic difference to even the most popular tabletop games. For you could say that the Pokemon card game, because Pokemon is a mega franchise, the Magic the Gathering and D&D are mainstream, but they are funny ones, because they already made it, because D&D and the Magic are very complex games, actually, compared to most of the stuff comes out that tries to find a place. And if they were released today and nobody knew the IP, they are good games, but might be tough sell.
Right, so the wider cultural context has a lot to do with it as much as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, we are making games for humans, aren't we?
You made it so simple, but of course it is, yeah. I've never considered it as that. Mm-hmm. That said then, how important, because we've just recently on our Discord group had a bit of a conversation about the importance of points within games, and there are various camps on the topic, but do you think points are absolutely necessary?
No, not at all. In many ways, it's easier to say that something like you can have one choice from here, two from here, three from here, one from here, two from here, pick them, and you're done. That's a lot easier. And all the loadouts are planned ahead, or maybe you just have some alternatives. But, for example, Trench Crusade, we made a decision that everything is costed in ducats, because that's more about you feeling as this is the narrative aspect, that you're the warband leader, you have limited resources. So you're thinking, I need another bolt action rifle, but I have only 7 ducats and not 10. So where the hell do I get that extra 3? I have to sell something. What it is? Man. There the points serve the immersion of the game. They make it more complex, but it is also, it stays more true to the experience we want to offer. But points are in no way necessary. Preset forces, select pre-made loadouts, select choices. You totally can make a good game with those.
The Minigamer is a free weekly email newsletter where I curate 5 cool things that caught my eye in the hobby this past week. Subscribe today and have the next edition sent straight to your inbox by going to bedroombattlefields.com/email. That's bedroombattlefields.com/email. And now, back to the show.
So for people that do these pick-up-and-play experiences and just meet, I wouldn't say a random person, but someone they've never met before, and they wouldn't have known that they would have met because they've just gone to a club or what have you, are points useful or, again, not necessary, depending on the game?
For the pick-up game, not necessary. In fact, it's better if there are ready-made forces. So this is like how we run all our demos. Is you just pick the force, and the person giving demos, it's the takes you through them, and the hopefully is quite merciful, because as you know, if you are a lot more experienced than the other player and the game has any skill element, of course you'd wipe the floor with them. But who will have a fun experience if they just get curb stomped before they get to do anything?
Not one person I've ever met would like that. And that then would allow them to get engaged with it and lead them down avenues where, like you say, you've designed something like the gold coins to immerse themselves in it. It's technically a point system, but like you say, you've added that layer on top.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other currency we have, the glorious glory points that you get from making glorious deeds. It is just another currency or point generator of different kind, if you will. But because you earn them pulling off some incredible feats of bravery, you feel that this is now your patron notices that you are a great hero and they want to reward you and you get some really special equipment. I could have made it very dull and the technical or just not have them at all. It's not like I couldn't have balanced it otherwise. But the point system serves the immersion and the it's a thing that you don't really get in the beginning. You start earning it through the campaign. So you really feel this is I earned this.
Your games that I've experienced are very, in their narratives and in their settings, are very grounded in a way that makes them feel like they're very adjacent to reality rather than adjacent to fantasy, as it were, pure fantasy. Are you quite inspired by history or settings for everything, for your narratives?
Hugely inspired by history. I mean, sure, I mean, Lord of the Rings has a massive influence in my life, but that's partly because Tolkien treated Middle-earth as a 100% real place. And he had the chops to do it. Very few writers have the kind of skill set as the Tolkien had. But I read a metric ton of history. Historical books, it's the historical novels too, if the I like the author, the lot of academic work. I consult academics, experts on their fields, and a big problem I see with a lot of lore crafters and the game designers is that this things happen because they have to happen in order for X to happen, but that's not how world works. You rather go, I want this in the game. Or the game world. Then you find out what would have to happen that it was there, let's say. Like, you can't just say there is a invasion of an island if the bad guys have no access to fleet or ships or flying or anything. And where did they get them, and where they build them, where do they come from? Even if you don't reveal it, the world itself, you don't want to immediately question that. Well, what the hell is going on here? This is not possible.
Is there a particular time period that you're drawn to as an individual more often than not? So many people, for instance, I believe Mr. Priestley said he's quite interested in the ancients, in particular Rome and things like this, and others are interested in different time periods. I myself, 1600s, Civil War era England. Do you have anything?
I like the big breakpoints, like the fall of Constantinople and Whereas so many people thought that the world was going to end, the Protestant Reformation, it's the and all the religious war, the end of the Hundred Years' War. It's the, everybody just always you see a movie and book and comic after comic about the early part where the English longbow rah 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 rah, it's killed everybody, we won, yay. But what really happened was that after Jeanne d'Arc is to refresh the French morale. Of course, it's both sides were really French. It's it was just a French royal house making the common people on both sides die. Everybody considers it England versus France. It was two French noble houses. But then the French, after Jeanne d'Arc have restored their spirits, they figure out that, hey, these cannons are pretty cool. And and they go, right, we are not going to fight open field battles against the English longbowmen unless we have time to set up our cannons. We'll do sieges. And they just went and just absolutely bollocked the English. You never hear about it because the Hollywood isn't interested in telling any French winning any battles. But to me, that what changed that it seemed like like after Agincourt that France is done. It's what changed. So it's those points in history when something really breaks and changes the beginning of the why was Franz Ferdinand dying so important that the World War I would start? It's how the hell did the Vietnamese kick the American teeth in, even though on paper in a million years they shouldn't have had any chance? All these interest me in history.
Have you found any kind of answer? Is it something to do with the cultural narrative shifting that inspires people?
It's always the people. There has been sometimes there has been some technological advance that has at least hastened the result, but almost all the wars. Let's look at the fall of Constantinople. Quite likely, if the bloody Christian Church would have gotten its act together and the Pope and the Latin Church would have decided that they want to help the Orthodox, they probably could have bought a army overseas that would have strengthened Constantinople enough that it wouldn't have fallen, but they couldn't. So again, taking nothing away from Muhammad the Conqueror, is a tremendously the successful sultan, but I always think that the things have a lot to do with the people, and very rarely about some overwhelming hero or anything. Because even Caesar, who was again ruthless but a brilliant man, could only crumple the Republic because it was crumbling already.
So the cultural narrative is an absolute interesting thing for me because it undergirds the majority of people's perceptions, not only themselves, but of them as a group and how they react to things. And it's that memescape that then opens up. But for instance, the resilience of the Finns in the Second World War because of that sense of themselves and that willingness to try, like you say, on paper, should not have been possible.
At that point, Soviet Union had more tanks than the rest of the world combined. It had more warplanes than rest of the world combined, more artillery than rest of the world combined, and of course, 8.5 million soldiers in the Red Army when the entire population of Finland was barely 4 million. But you never know how it goes. Sometimes something small happens that nobody saw coming, but it changes everything.
And those dark moments before it changes, is that the area you focus on for some of the games as settings? For instance, it feels very dark and pre one of those moments in Warhammer. Trench Crusade is very much a precursor to something that might be. Am I wrong in that? Or?
No, you're absolutely right. But it highlights and the strengthens the heroism of who the person who has my sympathies with is the common man or woman is the fighting for their homes, and they are the least responsible for everything that's happening. And the even though they can obviously have moral failures and others, it's the, you tend to sympathize with them because they are just people trying to survive. It's the fight for something they believe in. And if the enemy is not, if the situation is not grim and dark and challenging, then the you lessen the heroism. I mean, this was the in Lord of the Rings, it's the Sauron was overwhelmingly more powerful than the Free Peoples. Tolkien made it quite clear that the quest of the ring actually did not matter, because Tolkien had already stated that nothing, nobody, never could resist the ring. So getting to the Mount Doom, it was just a fool's errand in a sense that there was no way. It's the Gandalf knew. Frodo couldn't destroy the ring, because nobody could destroy the ring. But at least a circumstances had to be created where it was possible for the Free Peoples to win. So and this is, by the way, the genius of Tolkien. The book is called Lord of the Rings. You never see Sauron. And that makes him a billion times more terrifying. If Tolkien were describing with horns and the red eyes and whatnot, is the you lessen the absolute dread that his presence, that is, while he's never seen, but it's felt every second of the book.
Does that translate over to visual cues as well? Because I noticed in the films, obviously, you do see Sauron right at the beginning, and yet my experience of it was still, because they were very light with that, now he was an ancient evil that you didn't really know, and then they got rid of him straight away.
Oh yeah, that was the right decision. There was, you can still look it on YouTube, they did film him having a duel with Aragorn, and that would have absolutely lessened him so badly. This is true if you look at the original Alien movie, why the creature is so terrifying is that you see so little of it. Still, you need to leave some room in the people's imaginations, especially if you want horror. The best horror movies are very much in your mind rather than a CGI on the screen.
So things like H.G. Wells, where you really have no idea what it is beyond the veil, that Cthulhu thing that's just completely mysterious.
Yeah, and
is why it's horrifying.
Oh yeah, and you can also do a show something, but the if it's incomprehensible, like the I quite like the War of the Worlds. It's the because the usually the alien invasion movies are that the humans just beat them. And what I liked about the War of the Worlds, which is a very old book, was that humans have no chance, because H.G. Wells understood science. If they have technology to fly from Mars to here, we have no chance. I mean, they'll be so much more advanced than us that they will just wipe us out, which is exactly what happened. And then it was the again, this unforeseen event, the germs of planet Earth that the aliens had not, maybe it was just one of them that they had missed, that then killed them all and they allowed humans to get their planet back.
So do you have a personal favorite moment from any of your games, of a DM'd game or of a narrative game, that you think that was great, that epitomizes the kind of joy that can be unlocked with your craft?
Yeah, I mean, this has a lot to do with the atmosphere between you and your players, that you can't just translate into dice rolls or tables or rules. And there is a heroic companion, as my players were being pursued by a foe that there was no chance of defeating, and they formed a very strong bonds with this individual. And then he stays behind. It's the allowing the players to escape and explains them. It's the why he's doing it and how much he loves them. And my players are all in tears. This is something that you can't really get from just mechanics. That is something between human beings.
And that example you were thinking of, did that take a long time to build? Or were they to know each other for a few months, a few years? Where were they?
It was a long time. It's the people don't, we have strong social walls. So people don't easily open up like that in the front of even friends. It's the unless they truly trust them, because it leaves you vulnerable. And the they've also formed very strong bonds with this companion. So yes, some things take time. I mean, making a good game takes time. Is the, I think it's a good book, a good movie, a good game. Quite a lot of people try to rush through, and sometimes spending time just thinking about it when you're planning something is well spent, even if it looks like you are not actively developing anything.
So depending upon the game, let's say Warhammer, for instance, is there an ideal length for campaign then in your mind for that kind of thing?
I mean, obviously, it depends once again on the your players. For if it's six-year-olds, I'd say maybe three games is the beginning, middle, and end. Six games I found is quite good because it feels like a long journey, but this doesn't take forever. But then some people love to maximize everything. So I found that a monthly game for a year is a pretty good sort of, you feel like you went into a truly epic journey. So 12 games.
Yeah, over the course of a year. But D&D obviously is a very different thing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Would you have that longer or shorter, or do you just go with the flow?
Oh well, depends how often you play. But I try to play weekly, and I would say I finished one campaign in 4 years, another in six, and then one very short one in a year. What which I considered short in a year, and definitely the longer ones had more emotional impact because the so much had been shared between us.
And I presume invested, because they've invested themselves within their own.
Yeah. But it's you get out more if you put yourself more of yourself into it. And again, this is something that is very difficult to get in a one-off game. This is why lore can be very important, because let's say in the video game space, the Helldivers 2, let's say made by my friends in Sweden. Became so popular that you immediately get into the role of the managed democracy, where you are going into the alien worlds, because they threaten democracy here in on Earth, so you have to go and kill them there, so they don't become a danger to managed democracy, and everybody gets one vote. But there is never elections, and you get into this absurdist, very Starship Troopers kind of mindset, and everybody's immediately having great fun because they're role playing the stupid stormtroopers, that don't even realize that they are absolutely being used by their government, and it's a great fun. Everybody shouts these slogans, and the lore of the world draws you in immediately, and you are very much willing to give it a chance. But that's why lore can be important. It still can't, then once you start playing with your group, in this case Helldivers, and you become friends, and you take different roles, and support each other, and chat to each other, it still strengthens. But a good lore can give you the initial impetus.
You said you're quite a visual guy. I'm very visual tactile, hence why I'm in the hobby. With your D&D games, do you use miniatures in the scenery, or are you entirely theatre of the mind?
We've used miniatures a lot, but I have a lot of players who are not local here in Finland, so I've used virtual tabletop quite a lot, simply that it's easier to do that than try to share the miniatures table with them. I do the theatre of mind when tactical positioning doesn't matter. If you're just having one-on-one duel and the both of them are just melee sluggers.
You're very, very successful in the games that you've been involved with. And what would you say is the one that you have most fondness for, the one that you've executed with the greatest sense of it? So I'm a craftsman, I'm a carpenter myself, and I know that some projects I leave it going, bloody hell, I wish I did that differently. But on very rare occasion, there's a project where I go, I am so pleased with how I've engineered that. That is something special. And I presume you're the same.
Yeah. It's and remember, games are made by teams. So sometimes I've been very proud of what I've done, but the game necessarily didn't turn out as good as it should have because, and I'm not pointing fingers, but sometimes like the deadline is too tight for the programmers, or the artist lose somebody because of the illnesses at a crucial moment and the things go pear-shaped. But on tabletop, I would say the Mordheim purely artistically, because the absolutely stunning work that the John Blanche did to craft the artistry for that. But I say whole package, yeah, Trench Crusade, which is not surprising. I've obviously accumulated a lot more experience, and I had an absolute all-star cast team, like beyond dream team, like the stars aligned that so many of the best of the best of the best wanted to work with us on it. So I really had like the perfect shield wall.
That's superb. So you feel this is the pinnacle of your career in some sense, and this is the highest point you've got to with the Trench Crusades?
On tabletop, absolutely. Video game industry and the tabletop industry, comparing them is a little bit apples and oranges. They are not identical. With the video games, the technology has such a humongous role. It's the 800-pound gorilla in the room all the time. Doing a direct comparison, I would really have to treat those separately. But on tabletop, absolutely.
Do you have a game that you've came across, whether it's video game or whether it's tabletop game, that you would recommend anyone go to as you think that that is a marvelous piece of work? That is something that, as someone in the industry, like myself, when I've seen a certain piece of work in a palace where there's absolutely fantastic carpentry, you can't get better.
Well, I have several. It's the Pandemic board game series where the you literally, like, as you play it, let's say there's a playable card, that is, you get the choice of three, you have to tear the other two up. So you're physically changing the game as you make the decisions. Brilliant design. Absolutely genius. I like Saga on the Wargaming. It's very, very, very well-executed, easy to learn, difficult to master game, which they all should be, a historical game primarily. Ton of fun. I have to give D&D 5th edition its accolades for taking a 50, 60 year old game, no longer than that probably, and turning 50 year old game and turning it into something that the modern players can even grasp. Yeah, it had the D&D name, but you still have to appreciate how they paid homage to what the game is. So it is still D&D, but it is so much easier comparatively to get into. But the on a sort of a genius game design, in video games there is such a huge variety of the larger than life games. I really, for example, like Persona series, which is this RPG and a Japanese school simulator at the same time, which is a crazy combination, but somehow it works. And brilliant writing is one of the reasons. I love everything Nintendo does. It is the oldest game company in the world. They were already making games to the Ottoman Empire, 135 years now, I think, how old they are.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
When? How did they start then? Did you know anything about
it? They made playing cards and they made backgammon, I think. And the games like that, like I said, they made games that they sold to the Ottoman Empire. And they are still there, an Ottoman Empire. It's not, that's quite an achievement. But they produced a genius game after genius game. I've really artistically, Expedition 33 that came out last year and swept the award season. There are so many games that they admire, but those are just a couple off the top of my head. Legend of Zelda on the video games is probably the original, Ocarina of Time is probably my all-time favorite game. It was so groundbreaking. I can't convey that feeling. I love what Merkborg has done. It's the and how mutable it is. I love the Pirate Borg, for example. That book is hilarious and great fun and great book. But those are just a couple off the top of my head.
Superb. So your D&D games, do you use it just as an engine for any setting that you're interested in? You just apply it to whatever narrative and whatever setting you want, or are you keeping within the prescribed lore?
I use Forgotten Realms because I like to support it because of Ed Greenwood is a game designer that I think that's how it should be, that you start as a really young 8-year-old boy, you create this world, and then it becomes this huge thing. And he's still like independent creator. He's not a Hasbro employee, and he's making these videos and still loving his world. And I follow him and his love for the world he's crafted, even for its owned now by Hasbro. It's undiminished. He's a librarian. It's the game design is very much a hobby to him. So, I feel the love he has for the setting, and that makes me good about playing it. Plus, it's everything and kitchen sink world. So any kind of adventure I want to have, I can throw it in there. Plus, we're talking about the games I admire. Look at Baldur's Gate 3. That world has generated a absolute stunning game after game. Baldur's Gate 1, 2, and 3 are potentially the best trilogy ever created. It's certainly a strong candidate. It shows the strength of the world as a base for storytelling.
Do you have any? Thank you very much for giving me such comprehensive answers and everything I asked so far. Is there anything about campaigns that you think I've missed that's important? It's a generic sense. I know I've referenced certain games, but I've just done that just for an anchor point to the conversation rather than any reason.
I think it is important. Immersion is the number one to me. If the players are not fascinated by the world they are in, and the characters within it is I think you'll struggle. And I think you need goals. They can be short. If it's a sandbox, they can be short-term goals. But you always want to have them. And then very important is that the success and failure is the both should be interesting in some way. We talked about the catch-up mechanics and fail saves. If for a lot of games, stories, movies, books, say a death of a major character, even for it's traumatic, is also pivotal. So you should always, the game should handle a loss often better. That the loss or failure can lead into something new and interesting and exciting. And I think that's I mentioned to you that if I as a DM and your first level character, and for some reason we're using pure random encounters and we roll that ancient red dragon, there is no point running a combat. The player's already lost. But having a ancient red dragon as your overbearing evil boss that makes you do things. Now, that's interesting. So even for the role was a failure and the players lost the encounter, the narrative can lead into a new and exciting things and not just go that, okay, the red dragon killed you, game over.
And is that the same for mass combat games like Warhammer, like any others?
I think that obviously in one-to-one setting is even a total trouncing can be a great story. You could have the really incredible final stand, or sometimes a game that appears to that it's been lost, you manage to claw back on the last moment and have a come behind victory. That's exciting. So the important thing is that the game can handle it, and not every game can because it's very binary, winner or loss, and that's it. But what really helps once again is if it's a game has a great lore, then a lot of your work is done for you. Of course, if you know the history of the Dwarf Kings taking part in the combat, that alone is exciting. Let's see what happens to these legendary people that I'm really, really invested in.
Did you have anything that you think I've missed that you think is important on any of those points or any of the previous?
No. You can talk about a narrative and its role in games forever. It's an unending subject. So mainly I would say is I would encourage players to try it out. Even if you think you're not good at it, you might find out that you enjoy it.
Very few people do try it, don't they, these days? It seems to be very much more prescribed.
Yeah, I think the people are afraid of failure. It can be much more public because of the curse of social media. But it can also be very good, because if you create something people enjoy, then you see them posting about it, it can be a very happy and joyous. And I found this the mainly players, more often than not, is the they are just happy that somebody's doing something really interesting. So the gathering the social courage to try something is I encourage people to do it.
Will you be going on tour any time with your success with the Trench Crusade? Will you be going around Europe or UK at any point?
All the time. I was UK Games Expo last year at Epticon, Play Essen, and Germany this year. I'm going to Australia, UK again, Germany again. I'm going to Serbia, I think, France, Italy, all the time. It comes with the job.
What's your next date in the UK?
Possibly UK Games Expo. I have a lot of travel on that time slot, so let's see that if that happens. But I definitely want to come. Especially now, a lot of our team is in UK. Jervis Johnson, Andy Chambers, Brooke, they are all there. Obviously, all my old friends in the GW. It's the John Blanche. I go and see whenever I can.
Massive thanks to the guys there for that incredible chat. I really appreciate both of them for taking the time. These episodes always spark good conversations in the community as well, and you could have your say by going to bedroombattlefields.com/discord. That's bedroombattlefields.com/discord. All right, thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak again on the next one.